Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Bruce Bennett. Bennett received his PhD from Harvard University. He taught at Oberlin College from 1967 to 1970, and he is currently a professor and chair of English and director of creative writing at Wells College in Aurora, New York. He is author of 9 full-length books of poetry and more than 20 chapbooks. His new and selected poems entitled Navigating the Distances was chosen by Booklist as one of the top 20 books of 1999. His most recent books are Something Like Karma, published by Clandestine Press, and Subway Figure, published by Orchises Press. And I welcome you to the show, Bruce. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Tish, for having me.
Now, let's begin with the beginning. Do you remember when you first discovered poetry?
It seems like I've always lived with it. I think I wrote my first poems when I was about 8 years old, but it turned out I discovered afterward that my mother had also started writing poetry very young, and it seems like it was just always there. I do remember asking my third grade teacher very seriously whether I should wait. I don't think I used the word inspired, but whether I should wait for a poem to come or whether I should try to write poems. And she said to me, Mrs. Worthley was her name, and she said to me, you should always just try to write. And for a long time, actually through almost all my life, I have always wanted to write regularly. And about 20 or so years ago, I've written every day, even if it's something really short and something that might not be worth looking at or keeping. But I do really want to keep my hand in, and it's been very important to me to just do it on a daily basis rather than... I'm glad she gave me that answer.
Yeah, I was going to say that's good advice. Did you remember what your first poem was about or what it was?
I do, actually. I was thinking about it driving here, but it was in Rhyme Couplets, and it was about Sylvester Catfish. And I even remembered the opening lines, which were something like, Sylvester Catfish was a fish. He had many troubles, for the enemy fish would always see his bubbles. Of all his enemies, the dogfish was the worst. The easiest was the blowfish. When tickled, he would burst. Which I was rather proud of.
That is great.
The rhythm is not what I would have liked in a few places, but I seem to have always wanted to write in forms, and I've continued.
Yes, you have,
I write in all different forms, including free verse and prose poems, but form's been very important to me.
I can tell, And it works very well for you,
too. Thank you.
For some people, it does not, as we all probably
thank
know.
You.
Now, you said that you try to write every day, but does inspiration come, and are you somebody who'll stop your car and write things down on a matchbook cover?
I don't know who's listening to this. Sometimes I don't stop my car. I don't have a cell phone, but I do sometimes write while I'm driving. I try to write in my head, but every once in a while... I will usually pull over, but sometimes make a note. So I guess people should watch out for me. But yes, whenever it comes, I want to try to get it down in some form.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I might forget. But poems, one of the things about daily writing of any sort, and I tell students it's like meditation or like jogging or something, if you get into the habit, it happens for you. I mean, after a while, at first you sort of try. But things come to me. Sometimes it's in the morning walking the dogs. Sometimes it's later in the day. But if you're receptive and open, the poems, or at least something will come and then you work on it. I was also thinking of statements by poets that have meant a lot to me. I've sort of, ever since I first heard them, they're there and I use them in classes. But Wallace Stevens said, poetry is a response to the daily necessity of getting the world right. And Robert Frost said a poem is a momentary stay against confusion. So I think if writing anything regularly, you know, no matter what has happened, if I get it written, I will feel good enough about the rest of the day. It doesn't change the way things are, but it helps you accept the way things are.
Now, you've been writing poetry all of your life, obviously. Has it helped you make sense of the world and your life?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, in fact, it is the way I do it. One of the new books, Something Like Karma, is partly taking all the large questions that everybody thinks about and really thinking about them from the point of view of someone who doesn't have, you know, any kind of set beliefs, facing the world alone, asking the big questions, recognizing how small you are, but also that they are continuing. The questions are constantly there. You keep coming up with different answers. And I do think poetry is provisional. You know, what I think one day or feel one day, it might be different the next hour, certainly the next day or the next week.
That's why I think of poetry as painting. You know, you're in the mood for bright colors one day, and it becomes dark the other, you know, the next day.
And lyric poems are simply poems about a single speaker's state of thought and feeling, and we're always changing all the time.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of poetry comes from the subconscious?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite poets, I've been lucky enough at Wells to invite visiting writers since I've been there, since 1973, and I've had a lot of terrific writers. One of my favorites was William Stafford, and I use Stafford's little essay called A Way of Writing, you know, in the creative writing classes. And one of the things he always says is, you just have to trust your unconscious. You know, it's always there. He's one of the people that did daily writing. He got up earlier than everybody else. He'd get up at 5 or 6 in the morning, have a couple of hours. He said something always comes to you. You can always follow it. You don't have to be critical of it. Receptivity, the importance of just plain receptivity. And the other is, this comes definitely from the unconscious. In fact, the conscious in some ways is an enemy. It's good later on, but you know, you don't go around looking for the subject of a poem. When it comes to you, then you start working.
So later on, the conscious mind is the one that helps you polish?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, or even once it started, it can guide you. But it's a collaboration of the unconscious and the conscious. And I've written a lot of sort of poet and poem poems where the poet is a character and the poem is a character. The poem is always the one that's right. I mean, some are satirical and some are serious, but the poet is sort of the person who's there, who's doesn't quite get it, and the poem is always wiser and deeper, and I really believe that. I just quoted in class the other day one of my favorite comments, D.H. Lawrence in Studies in Classic American Literature said, trust the tale and not the teller. You know, the artist is likely to lie, but the tale, the work itself, will tell the truth.
Oh, that's an interesting point of view. Yeah. I had never heard that.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard that once you start writing a poem, you have to finish it. And if anybody gets in your way, you get ornery and upset. To tell us about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I'm different. I would never, you know, I love working with students, but it's very important that they find their own way, their own, not just their own voice, but everybody works differently. I, for a long time, and I don't know why, have felt kind of the compulsion, if I'm working on something, to finish it. And if I work every day, that means writing a lot. But even when I've written reviews, I get really kind of anxious that I haven't finished. Those take more than a day. But I really find with a poem, if I can get it down, it may need some polishing and finishing, but I just don't stop in the middle of it. And it doesn't take me very long at this point. But also, I think it explains I mostly write shorter poems. And, you know, every day it's something new. And as you said, you know, it could be totally different. I mean, it could be dark, it could be light.
Well, that's represented in all of your work. Now, I want to have you read a couple of poems from Navigating the Distance, is your collection. The poems that I've chosen are What You Need and Pilgrimages to My Teacher. Tell us a little bit before you read them.
Sure. Actually, I don't remember much about writing it. I like the poem, but I think it stresses, without saying too much about it, a kind of minimalism. What you need. And one thinks, oh, well, if you're going to be a skydiver or a skier or something, you know, what do you need in terms of equipment? What's the situation? So I was sort of thinking, ironically, what does a poet need? Okay. What you need. First, you must have a life. Put it aside. You'll need people, but they must be absent. You won't need ideas. Have something to write on, or memory, and with, or memory. And, oh yes, change. You'll want change. A window will do, or a mirror, or a clock.
That's great.
Thank you. Pilgrimage. Pilgrimage to Me. I'm really glad you chose this, partly because being a teacher and also having benefited from really good teachers, they've meant a great deal to me. And I've talked to other people often, and when they've read this poem or my poem After School, which is about the same teacher that meant a lot to me in my junior and senior year in high school, they've just said how important a particular teacher has been to them. Mm-hmm. And for a writer, I think in some ways it's not just somebody who turns you on to things or is supportive, but there's a kind of a fear involved in... It's one of your early tests of, am I worthy, am I good? You know, a lot of people say, I just want to be such and such. That's my purpose in living. Well, what if you're not good enough? Mm. You're always facing this possibility. And when you're really young, you know, other people know more and they have authority. So with great trepidation, you approach somebody you greatly respect. I mean, he will know. And what if he says, this isn't very good? So I had this teacher, and actually, if I could, the other poem's pretty short, but sure. It's mm-hmm. the same teacher in junior and senior year in high school. I used to go to him after classes, and I would have poems with me, and I think my hand was literally shaking. And
what's the name of this one?
This one's called After School, mm-hmm. and I could hear the football team practicing outside, and all I was interested in is, are these poems good enough? What is he going to say about them? So this is called After School. You have poetry in you, he pronounces, as he leafs through my efforts. This is a skimpy one. Here, my eyes follow his finger. You almost get it. You could do more with this. Outside, the clash of helmets, yells, and commands mean nothing to me, intent on that faint hallowing from farther fields, the scrimmage that goes on and on. After I graduated, I went for many years to visit him at his house. And one of the things I told him was I really appreciated, we spent almost the whole last semester of my senior year in high school reading Robert Frost's selected poems. Mm. And afterward, I said to him, I was really glad that meant a lot to me. My mother was from Amherst. She knew Frost when she was a child. And he said, oh, well, I did that for you. The rest of the class wouldn't have cared what we read. So he did a whole semester of Robert Frost poems just because I was in the class.
Wow. Can I have you read this?
Sure. So this is called Pilgrimages to My Teacher. And the title of Navigating the Distances comes from this. I was always disappointed. I thought if I provided clues, you would present me with myself, not just good talk, shrewd observation, the kind of insight I could find someplace else. I sorted them out and handed them over. You chuckled and poked at the fire. Still, on those long drives home, navigating the distances back to my parents, I became who I was. No one I could fix a name to, no one I could explain or hope to reveal ever, not even to you, though your presence had called him forth, though I knew you would recognize him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Bennett. He's a poet and professor of English at Wells College in Aurora, New York. Now you've been the co-founder and editor of several literary journals. How do you navigate that world? And there's so many people who think they're poets.
Actually, I have been part of groups that have founded magazines, and I've been very pleased to serve as an editor. I was never the initiator of the group, fortunately. So I've had experience as an editor. I certainly very much enjoy it. I think I would not like to be the primary editor often. It is difficult because part of teaching is enabling and encouraging. And I think everybody, it's evident in the two poems I read about teachers, I think people really trust and need teachers to be honest, but mm-hmm. they also need teachers to, you know, tell them the truth about their work and try to help them. And editing is kind of different. You know, an editor's whole reputation depends on the quality of the judgment.
Yeah, and editors.
And it is objective.
And traditionally, editors don't have time to answer each and every poet, which is what people get hurt by, I'm sure.
When I was one of the editors of Plowshares when it first started, it was a bunch of us in Cambridge who were starting it. And we said we wanted to distinguish ourselves from other magazines. So we said we would give a response to every submission. We changed that by the second issue. But this was a serious national literary magazine.
It's a great one. I knew about it, too, from years back. Yeah.
And I, as one of the editors, one of the responses I had to give was to a ninth grader's handwritten Moby Dick paper because she didn't know what a literary magazine was.
No.
So I was kind, but I said it wasn't exactly what we were looking for. Yeah, it is true. I think it's a different world.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that I can encourage. The other thing about bringing in visiting writers is that's another, you know, sort of that's the real world of professionals who are committed totally to writing. And they've been wonderful in terms of coming to classes and sharing their work. Mm-hmm. But I think students need exposure to that as well
absolutely.
As encouragement in the classroom.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you teach a course on major American poets of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides who's a major American poet? I mean, are there people in robes like the Supreme Court deciding these things?
It's a very good question. I also teach contemporary American poetry. And I announced at the beginning of that class that if people were taking this class at any other place with any other teacher, there might be 15 or 20 totally different poets. In terms of who's established, the five poets I teach are Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Wallace Stevens, Robert Frost, and William Carlos Williams.
No women, huh?
And that Wells was a women's college.
I know.
And for a long time, I said this and I was aware of it, but I said it and I asked students afterward, you know, how they felt about that. One student, one year when Wells was very much a women's college, said, "Don't change a thing." So, now it's partly certain figures that I simply felt, you know, people had to know in order to read 20th century American poetry. I have to say, on the other hand, the contemporary American poetry course is almost all women, and I adapted early on. But
how could you miss out on Emily Dickinson or Elizabeth Barrett Browning from those guys from?
it was contemporary American, or modern American. So Emily Dickinson is one of my favorite writers,
okay.
But she wouldn't have been part of. If she had been in the 20th century, she would have been featured.
So you do teach some of the storied women from the 19th
absolutely.
And 18th century.
Absolutely. I teach. In fact, in the contemporary class, I did slip William Stafford in and a couple of other male writers, but for most of the time I've been teaching it, it's been mostly women writers. And, for example, Lucille Clifton, who recently died, you know, she was among the favorites. We've had just so many people that have meant so much to students.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how has the Internet changed the landscape of poetry? Has it made it more of a fair ground for people to be able to publish?
It's very interesting, and I think we're still at the beginning. Some people adapted to it right away. A lot of me still feels like something hasn't really been published unless it's been in print in a magazine. Mm. But students are going to be living in a different world. I've published fairly regularly in a couple of internet magazines that I'm very proud to be in. One is called the Innisfree Poetry Journal. Everything can be Googled now, for example. But first of all, I think many more people read these than read in the print magazines. And second, they're really juried. They've got editors who care a lot about the quality of work. Mm-hmm. And so there's not much difference with a really good online journal that there is with the print journals, except that hardly anybody. I've published in some very good places over the years, but nobody except other poets ever reads them. And I have a feeling it's much easier to say to somebody, you know, just go online and look at this and you can see it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I would like you to read a couple more poems from Navigating the Distances.
Mm-hmm.
Lessons. It's a very gorgeous piece that I think you wrote. And I want you to read The Human Factor, too, because that's about sociology in some way.
Yeah, it's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Lessons. This is in five parts, and it just a one-line title and a one-line answer. What the stream sang, all of my voices are me. What a flower cried, I can drink the air. What leaves say, we are many, we shall return. What the rushes sigh, wind, oh, wind. What stone claims, it's easy, lie down.
That one's beautiful.
Thank you.
Now the human factor.
Sure, the human factor. My wife is a Renaissance art historian, and so we've had to spend a lot of our time, and so have our children, in Florence. Would nobody feel sorry for me?
Poor Mr. Bennett.
And one year, we were a great year for the family and the family dog. We were both had a sabbatical, and Bonnie was working at Itati, which is the Harvard Renaissance Center up in the hills. And I was left alone and did a lot of work. We also had a TV, which we didn't regularly watch, but one time it was on, and I was just walking past it, and I noticed it was a documentary about homelessness, and it was a close-up of a man, and I just sort of stopped because I got caught by what he was saying. And I wrote this poem. It's called The Human Factor. The homeless man says he is on the street because he likes it. Because he likes to drink, because he likes living there. You stop to listen, sensing this is important. Even if you was to give me a home, he says, staring straight into the camera, I'd be back here. I know it's bad for me. He takes a swig and wipes his mouth. I know it's going to kill me. I like it anyway. He coughs and sets down the bottle. He is self-possessed, dignified. Even if you was to give me a home, his eyes locked onto yours, I'd do it anyway.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great. Are you somebody who believes that poetry should be used for political comment and social comment, or should it be a beautiful thing to uplift the spirit?
No, I think if it's serious and doing its job, it's going to touch on everything human. And I think a lot about this because I write so many different kinds of things, but I think of poems in one way as psychological documents. I think if the poet is honest about emotional things and explores and is accurate, and we are like each other in a lot of ways, that he or she is doing that for other people. Mm. In other words, even an I poem, even a poem that seems personal or even possibly confessional, I think of as something where people can see themselves in it. That when I'm writing, I'm always thinking in some ways that this is representative of other people's mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think more than overtly political poetry that just takes a stand and in that sense might be like an editorial, it might be passionate, you might totally agree with it, I think the best poems go much deeper than that. I think we really have to, we can learn things from them. And you mentioned Emily Dickinson, you know. I think people can just learn so much about everything mm-hmm. from her work.
Yeah.
It's so
the
tragic.
The everyday
yeah. raised to, you know, some power beyond mm-hmm. what we can even say.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that poetry does bear witness to everybody's individual life, especially their inner life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, William Carlos Williams says that people die every day in need of poetry without knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quoting him accurately, but when Wallace Stevens said poetry is a response to the daily necessity of getting the world right, the poet writes out of that necessity,
mm-hmm.
but I think if people understand what poetry can do, they will also read it out of that necessity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a good poem or a good essay or a good piece of literature also sets their world right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very serious thing. I mean, it's not ornament and it's not luxury and it's not superficial. It's
I agree.
One of the most
Absolutely.
Profound ways in which we can engage with the world.
Yeah. It's certainly touched my life, all of my life. Do you think you can really teach someone the language of poetry, or can you mainly teach technique?
I think that if they are exposed to really good poetry, and includes poets in person, but in books, and they are open to it, I really believe in the workshop process. Mm. I believe people go in, they're opening themselves up, they listen, and I think they learn that way. I've taught at Wells for all of these years. I can't even think of a time, yes, one time, actually, when I've had a workshop where, you know, people weren't comfortable because, you know, they didn't want to show stuff. I mean, people are always a little hesitant at first.
Oh, sure.
But it's a wonderful process. Everybody has something to contribute, and the person comes out of it hearing respectful opinions. And I just said to somebody yesterday, somebody may misread a poem, or it may not be doing what you want it to do. Not everybody's a good reader, but you should listen. And for example, with the poem we were talking about, I think it's because you didn't do exactly what you needed to, not because people weren't reading it right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, you're opening yourself up, but what better way to grow and learn?
Yeah, absolutely. And we only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
I would love for you to read a poem from Subway Figure, because I want people to get a taste of some of your humor. This one's called Open House.
Yes, and this poem, actually, part of Subway Figure, I've incorporated sections from something like Karma, which is the somewhat earlier book, and I incorporate it because, in a way, the whole book is responding to sort of the context of a life.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in something like Karma also, but it's called Open House. And a lot of these poems are about the self, and the fact of people talking about some of these poems referred to Buddhism. I don't know much about Buddhism, but I think I'm very sort of...
in touch with it.
Well, I seem to be. People keep acknowledging that. But the self, which does it really exist? If it does, what is it? So this is sort of about that. Open house, it's just 8 lines. I let myself be what I am, which isn't really me, although it's also not a sham, since nothing I can be is ever any more than what each moment brings to bear, eclipsing all the selves I'm not, whenever they're not there.
I love that.
That's
a great note to end on. Bruce Bennett, we have run out of time. Can you give a website?
Yes, actually, if you Google Bruce Bennett poetry, there is another Bruce Bennett, but I think that will be what comes
Bruce up. Bennett poetry.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I hope people will get in touch with you and read some of your work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tisha. It's been fun.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.